sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
It's time to accelerate. Hey friends, this is Andy. Welcome to episode 754 of Accelerate, the sales podcast of record. Joining me this week as my guest is Brendan McAdams. Brendan is the author of the book titled Salescraft: Proven Tips, Practices, and Ideas to Advance Your Sales Success. Now, it's a very good book full of practical information for sellers, good for beginners and experienced sellers alike. Brendan is also the co-founder of ExpertScape. It's a web portal where anyone can go and search for and identify the best medical experts in a broad variety of fields. Now, no matter how far you get into your sales career, you can't lose sight of the fundamentals, you know, the little details that enable you to build a connection with another person that leads to the sale. And among the topics Brendan and I are going to get into today are, A, why a sale is never over, what it means to be reliable and why that's never out of style in sales, how to ensure that every sales touch has value for the buyer, and why humility and humor move the needle with your buyers. Now, it's all very interesting. We'll be getting into all of that and much, much more. But before we get to Brendan, I'm going to talk for a minute with William Tyree, Chief Marketing Officer of RingDNA, about RingDNA's Sales Madness Bracket Challenge. Now, if you're longing for some non-virus-related madness this March, then check out this bracket challenge. 64 of the top sales books of all times are pitted against each other in 6 rounds of competition, just like the NCAA tournament. And at the end, one influential book is crowned the champion. Now, as I have over the past couple weeks, I'm bringing on my friend William to talk about some of the key matchups in this round. William Tyree, welcome back to Accelerate.
Thank you, Andy. How are you today?
I'm doing well. So let's jump into this. We're talking about results from round one of the Sales Madness Bracket Challenge, sponsored by RingDNA. And there are a couple of notable upsets.
There were, actually. I think one of the most impressive upsets was pulled off by Nancy Bleek. She came into this tournament as a 56 seed. She knocked off the number 9 seed. So her book, Conversations That Sell, knocked off How I Raised Myself from Failure to Success in Selling.
Yeah, and Frank Betker's book has been around forever. And yeah, I mean, Nancy's book is a good book. I mean, it's we've had her on the show a couple times, and she's scheduled to come on again soon. I mean, it's a great topic, right? I mean, conversations that move the needle. I think I'll call me at the recency bias, maybe worked in her favor there.
Something did. She's definitely got a passionate fan base because, that contest wasn't even all that close, frankly.
No.
Her base clearly came out for her in droves. So,
yeah. So speaking of that, then is another bigger upset was The Science of Selling, written by David Hoffeld, beating out Predictable Revenue by Aaron Ross and Mary Lou Tyler. Now, Predictable Revenue certainly is sort of the playbook Bible, if you will, of the SaaS industry.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, that busted my my bracket right there. Actually, I had, even though Predictable Revenue was a 22 seed, I just see it being so influential across, you know, B2B, you know, every SDR I've ever known has read it. You know, it's one of the first books that they read. So I had it going all the way to the Final Four, but clearly I underestimated the passion for The Science of Selling.
Yeah, and then I think one other one worth talking about in that regard is sales differentiation by my friend Lee Sauls beating out Sell It Like Sirhan.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was actually a very close race. That one, you know, if you think your vote doesn't count, well, this is not the Electoral College, people. I mean, the margin of difference there was, you know, about 1%. So, you know, really close race there.
Yeah, see, that one didn't surprise me because, yeah, I may be old school, but yeah, a celebrity book on sales, that's not a real sales book for B2B sellers as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, I had sales differentiation on my bracket.
Oh, your bracket's busted too. We're going to have to see where we stand here internally.
Yeah. Well, I think I lost some for sure in the first round. But so let's talk about some of the upcoming second round matchups. And this is the round of 32, if you will. Mm-hmm. And what were the ones that you thought really sort of stood out in this round for you?
You know, I think that a really interesting one is the Sales Development Playbook by Trish Bertuzzi mm-hmm. versus Go For No, Richard Fenton and Andrea Waltz. I mean, I know that you know you're intimately familiar with you know these authors.
Yeah,
I just love to know. Yeah, I mean, how do you see that one playing out? Why might people be passionate for one book over the other?
Well, I think it's sort of the difference is if there is. A difference I think makes a difference in the voting is I think that Go For No really speaks to the individual seller, whereas mm-hmm. the Sales Development Playbook, which is a fantastic book, but really speaks more to a manager and a sales leader, so perhaps a smaller audience. And I think given that Go For No had such a big turnout in round one, I'm predicting it prevails in this round.
Awesome. You know, behind the scenes, I think another one that is trending in a way that I would not have expected so far is How to Get a Meeting with Anyone by Stuart Heineke mm-hmm. versus Way of the Wolf, Jordan Belfour. Jordan Belfour has got to be, you know, one of those salespeople, the rare salesperson that is, you know, super famous beyond just, you know, sales industry and the sales profession. And I'm just really surprised. I think Stuart Heineke's fan base is really super engaged and, you know, it's looking like we might get an upset on that one.
Well, I think that's another case of what I just talked about is, first of all, Jordan Belfort's not a B2B seller. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, he's a celebrity, but quite frankly, I don't know any serious B2B seller who's read that book. That, you know, again, I may have a little bias going there. But Stu's book, especially in this day and age of remote selling, How to Get a Meeting yeah. with Anyone, full of so many practical ideas and advice about how to reach out and get through to the person you need to get through to in a way mm-hmm. that's again, very practical, very professional. And I think it just has more value than the Way of the Wolf. So that's my prediction is that Stu's book prevails in this round.
More value than Sell Me This Pen? Come on, Andy. No, yeah. I kid Way of the Wolf. But I see what you mean. They definitely have different audiences and yeah, it's going to be interesting to see the one this plays out. But so far, I think these people are definitely bringing it.
Yeah, well, I think the same thing sort of goes with the matchup between Sell or Be Sold by Grant Cardone versus New Sales Simplified by Mike Weinberg. You know, one is really a book for salespeople, and mm-hmm. one is, yeah, sort of a celebrity thing that, yeah, personally, I don't find any value in. I think that I found the psychology behind it is not what's needed. And so I think, yeah, a real sales book for real sellers is going to win. So I predict New Sales Simplified in this round.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. You know, it's interesting. There's a lot of, as a marketer, right? And as a marketer who's managed salespeople, like there's a lot of books that I think of as marketing books, for example, that aren't even in that category in Amazon. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be interesting to see if some of that bigger tent phenomena plays, how that plays into, you know, this tournament or not.
Well, I think both those books have big audiences. So, but I just think that New Sales Simplified is going to become a classic in sales book lore, if you will, or the canon of sales books. So, yeah, I'm sticking with that one.
Fair enough. I can't wait to see how it turns out.
Yeah. Do you have any others of the matchups you want to preview for the coming round?
Well, you know, I think that what's interesting for me is to see, you know, speaking of books that kind of get famous beyond their core niche, mm-hmm. I think a book like that is actually Influence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've known a lot of salespeople and marketing people who just love that book. It did really well in the first round,
yep.
Even though it doesn't fit neatly into that genre. So we'll see. You know, that's one that I've got going all the way to the final four, but, you know, can't wait to see how it turns out.
Yeah, well, I think that Influence will. I mean, that's one I'm certainly predicting will move on to the next round. Yeah, I think another book sort of in a similar vein is The Coaching Habit by Michael Bungay Stanier. Versus it's sort of an interesting matchup in this round against Never Eat Alone by Keith Ferrazzi. And, you know, ostensibly you'd say, well, okay, well, these aren't really classic sales books. But if you read The Coaching Habit, and I've had Michael Bungay Stanier on the show a couple times, I've had Keith Ferrazzi on the show. But if you read Michael's book, it takes you through a coaching methodology for, you know, how you as a manager interact and help develop the capabilities and skills and problem solving abilities of somebody that's working for you. But when you look at his process, that's really fundamentally a great sales process. The way you question people. Mm-hmm. Really excellent. So that's why I always recommend it as a great sales book, even though it's ostensibly about coaching. Fantastic for sales professionals. And same with Keith's book. I mean, if you want to talk some terms about building your network and the value of a network that you build and what it can do for you and what you can do for people, also an excellent book. But yeah, I give the edge to The Coaching Habit.
That's a blind spot for me. And since you highly recommend it, I'm going to have to move it way up in my queue.
You need to. And that book has been a huge bestseller, under the radar. Most people don't know it. So yeah. Recommend it.
Can't wait.
All right. Well, William, let's see what next week holds.
Absolutely. Encourage people to go out and vote. And, they can do that at ringdna.com/salesmadness.
ringdna.com/salesmadness. And as they like to say in Chicago politics, vote early, vote often.
You got to invoke Chicago. Poor Chicago.
There's no limit on the number of times people can vote. So
that's right.
Yeah,
it is kind of like Chicago politics.
Yeah, yeah. So you don't even have to be dead to vote, as they do oftentimes in Chicago, or used to in Chicago. So yeah, encourage people, if you're a fan of a book, you know, get your fellow fans together and just show how influential it's been in your life. And we'll see the results of this next round next week, and we'll have William back to talk about it then. Thanks, William.
Thank you so much, Andy.
William, thanks again. Friends, make sure you go vote for your favorite books at ringdna.com/salesmadness. That's ringdna.com/salesmadness. All right, let's jump into it. Brendan, welcome to Accelerate.
Hi, Andy. Good to be here.
Yeah, we've been trying to do this for a long time.
Yeah.
So you're joining us from where today?
I'm in Baltimore.
Baltimore.
Yeah.
You pronounce the T. I thought you weren't supposed to do that if you're local.
I'm not. I'm a transplant from elsewhere. So I enunciate every letter.
So we're going to delve into the book that you've written, a really nice book, I thought. Called Salescraft. But before I do that, you've wanted to learn about the business that you're in right now, which I think is a fascinating business as well, a company called Expertscape, which I spent some time on last week, actually. And why don't you tell us what it's all about?
Sure. It's a website that identifies and objectively ranks medical expertise by specific topic. And the way we do that is we use the PubMed repository, and that's part of National Institute of Health, which is really kind of a national treasure. It's where anything of any consequence that's written about any biomedical topic ends up there and gets indexed there. And we take that data and analyze it by specific topic, of which there are now 29,000 different topics. And And then we identify who the most knowledgeable people are using an algorithm that we've patented. And there's just really nothing else like it.
And so you're, I mean, to rank their expertise, are you, you know, looking at, you know, mentions online, cites and citations of publications and so on?
It's strictly based on what they publish and the not just the amount, but the quality, the importance of what they publish. So there's a thing in publications called an impact factor of a journal. And so the New England Journal of Medicine and The Lancet have a very high impact factor. And so that's one of the components that goes in the algorithm is how prestigious, how important is the journal where you're being published? What are you publishing on? Like, what kind of a paper? Is it a clinical trial? Is it a guideline? Is it an editorial? That sort of thing. Are there attractions? All those things kind of go into it. And then we compute those for 29,000 different topics. And so you'll appreciate this. We've moved into what is an expert economy. It's what you do. You basically are trying to make people experts in sales.
Right.
And in medicine, it's the same thing. There's an expert economy, and the people at the very top are in tremendous demand, and it's very important. And so people are looking for experts in serious conditions. So when someone's diagnosed with a serious problem, you don't go to a cancer specialist. You go to a lung cancer specialist. You go to someone who really knows multiple myeloma anymore.
Well, that's what I was looking at last week, because a close friend has brain cancer, and so glioblastoma. So I was looking at the experts, and the expert that she's been consulting here in the LA area is right at the top of your list. So,
oh, really? Yeah, okay.
Good to see that.
That's great. And we hear those stories over and over and over again. So it's really encouraging when we hear that. And I always lead with, I hope you never have to use our site, really, because ideally, you go to our site when you've been diagnosed with a chronic problem that's not getting resolved or you've got a serious complication. You don't use our site if you're trying to find a primary care physician or you need a colonoscopy. You know, you know, there are people that are really good at those sorts of things and they don't publish, but so we don't know about them.
So what's your business model? How are you making money on this?
It's a combination of things, and that's kind of the complexity of it is there's a reputational component. So we liken ourselves a little bit to like J.D. Power. Mm-hmm. If you took J.D. Power and crossed it with a global provider physician directory, that's kind of what we are. And so there's a kind of advertising promotion component, and that's where we're doing a lot of work. I'm selling to and working with large academic medical centers on their awareness campaigns and reputation, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. That's one model. It also, there's an advertising traffic model, you know, for people to come to the site. One of the things about our site is you don't go there to browse. You know, people that come
to the expert with a purpose, right?
Yeah, you're there for a very specific reason, and so when you get to a certain page on the site, of which there are frankly millions of pages, you're highly self-qualified. You know, you've identified yourself as, you know, I have Crohn's disease, and I'm looking for someone in California or Alabama, and so who are the experts in that geographic area?
Right.
Cool. And some people will fly a long distance to get treatment.
Absolutely.
And some people won't. One thing I will say is that it's kind of really important for us is that we want to stress is there are centers of excellence all over the world. And there are people that are really knowledgeable about this stuff in very unpredictable areas.
Right.
They're experts in at the University of Khartoum and who are top notch and
in what?
And go ahead and said, in lung cancer.
Really? In Khartoum.
So, yeah. And yeah. And Italy has a real strength in lung cancer. My sister died of lung cancer years ago. And that was one of the things that, so I'm kind of fueled a little bit by, by that as well.
Italy may have expertise in the coronavirus here soon. So
yeah, and we're getting a ton of traffic now on,
right, I'm sure,
infectious disease. And, yep. Yeah. So it's and it's fascinating to see where it comes from. So and you know where the you know we get traffic now from Italy and from France because they're having it's blooming. You know, it's
right.
It taking off in some of these areas. So it's kind of fascinating that way.
Excellent. All right. Well, that's ExpertScape, and yep. I'll give you a chance to give some information about that later on. So I want to talk about your book, Salescraft.
Yes.
Proven tips, tactics, and ideas to elevate your sales success. And part of the reason I really enjoyed reading the book as I was going through it is you weren't trying to boil the ocean. You weren't trying to cure everything. It was just some, as you said, sort of practical reminders about things that are so important, I think, in sales that don't get enough attention, which are sort of values and character oriented, as you talk about, just sort of basic human decency and how far that takes you.
Yeah, it's so true. And I listen to your podcast with some frequency and I know that, I mean, we kind of agree on a lot of things, but to me, a lot of success in sales in particular is fundamentals. It's doing little things consistently and, you know, it's follow up and the like. And so I've kind of collected over the years a number of these little kind of ideas and, you know, practices and techniques that I just think are kind of fundamental to the profession. And I've just been writing them down forever. And so then I decided I wanted to kind of compile them in a way that you could pick up the book at any point and read something. You don't have to sit there and, you know, plow through it from start to finish. And it's not a sales system. It's here are things to kind of reminders, things to think about.
Right. And I think this is such an important lesson for people to keep in mind who are in sales is that, yeah, there is a sales methodology, yeah. But beneath it, there are these just basic, as you said, human decencies, human kindnesses, practical tips that you need to be practicing. And because if you don't, because a lot of them have to do with sort of the first impression you create with another human being. And I think I sort of lump a lot of what you talk about into this really important category I call just being a good human. And it's surprising how far that can take you. It's just to be a good human. Just start with that. And if you aren't, and you can layer all the methodology you want on top of that, you know, that human connection you need to make with your buyer, it just won't happen. And as I like to say, you'll be fighting for second place from the beginning. You won't even know it.
Yeah. I can't agree more. I mean, it's amazing how far just doing certain things over and over again consistently. It's like in football, in you know American football. I know you're kind of a football of the other persuasion.
Big soccer fan. Yeah,
big soccer. Right. So in American football, like as if you're a lineman, footwork is critically important. Mm-hmm. I mean, just. Have boxing the same.
Yep.
You know, boxing, it's so much of his success is in footwork because it just positions you and so forth. And it's true in sales. If you do certain things over and over again consistently, you can differentiate yourself with a large percentage of the sales population.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? But that is absolutely true. And I was having this conversation with somebody this week is sort of, okay, what had been, I don't say the secret to my success, but the things that I thought made a difference when I was selling. And it was so many of the things that you talk about in the book is just these basic human values and character issues that really reflect who you are as a person. And that's the first thing people judge you on. It's not your knowledge. It's not your credibility. It's just, are you a person I want to connect with and interact with and perhaps find you trustworthy enough to a degree that we can do business at some point?
That's right. Yep.
All right. Yep. Well, I want to run through some of these because because I just want to stress them. I just like the way you wrote about
sure.
it.
Sure. Fire away. Yeah.
So one is talk about is the importance of being prepared. And I thought you had given an interesting example that I thought would be interesting because you said there's a great chance that the job you interview for won't be the job you end up doing. And so explain what you meant by that.
In terms of for a sales gig?
Yeah.
It's happened to me so frequently now that I've been Well, in fact, what's happened is I've been on my own as a sales consultant for the last 9 years. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, I had gone in and interviewed with companies where, like, I knew the people on the board, I knew the CEO, I knew, these were like cold, you know, these were referral, these were reference, sure. Opportunities. And the surprising thing to me is until you're on board, my experience has been that you don't have any real confidence that the job you're going to do is the job you've been hired for is the job you're going to do. And I don't know exactly what the defense is, except that it's a sales opportunity in the same way. And that is the qualification is so important. And I think one of the things that I find that salespeople, especially inexperienced salespeople, tend to do is they get worried about losing a deal because they ask the wrong question. They ask a difficult mm-hmm. question. And ultimately, that's going to come back and bite you. And so there's a chapter in the book where I talk about killing a deal. And one of the fundamental things is you have to discover what the thing is that's going to kill the deal for you. And you have to confront that. You have to find a way to really uncover that, to either get the person on the other side to agree with you that mm-hmm. this is an obstacle and you can't overcome it, or to dispute it and argue in favor of hiring you or buying from you. And I think, I guess the one lesson I would take away from those employment experiences is you really have to be hyper aggressive, I think, and in trying to uncover what could go wrong before you take the job. I don't know how helpful that is. I mean, what's your experience?
Well, I think it's a very common experience. And I think it's very analogous to customers buying a product, right? Is there's always this gap between the expectation and the reality.
Yeah.
And what I took from your book when you're saying be prepared for that is being prepared for the fact that, yeah, what you bought is different than what you're actually going to be getting. And so too, from your employer, what they thought they bought as a result of you selling yourself to them is probably different as well. Not necessarily in a bad way, but it's just, it's so hard to align the expectations. The point I took away from that part was just, you got to be prepared that this is reality. This is how it happens. So you got to be resilient. You got to be tough, aggressive, as you talked about. And just understand that you're not ever as clear as you think you are.
And I guess a corollary for me is that I've kind of come to the conclusion, as a result of my experience, that the sale is really never over. You're never you may get the contract signed, but like I've had a number of contracts signed where you don't implement. You may even get the money, but you don't have the satisfaction of having a successful customer. And so in a lot of cases, I find that in most cases, the sale's never over. And especially in the kind of work that the kind of selling I've always done has been enterprise level selling. And so you're always working on that engagement. You may have gotten the contract, but that does not mean that all the work is done.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's a way for people to sort of think about it is that there's sort of these multiple stages in a relationship that sociologists and psychologists have defined. And the first stage of the relationship is they call a fledgling relationship stage.
Yeah.
And you think about, fledgling bird, don't know how to fly. You're just getting to know each other. But the fact is decisions take place in that stage, the purchase decisions. And then you have sort of the steady state stage. And then you have what they call a transition stage where eventually the relationship evolves and changes. What sellers have to understand is that, your buyers are making decisions before they have this fully formed relationship with you.
Right.
And if you want to maximize the value you can provide the customer and the revenue value of the opportunity, you got to build on that relationship. That building doesn't stop when you get the order. In fact, it's still in the early fledgling stage of a relationship.
That's right. That's right. Exactly right.
All right. I love this one. Be on time.
Yeah, right. Show up when you say you're going to show up. It just you know, it's like a buddy of mine always uses the phrase Lombardi time.
Yeah.
And, be a few minutes early. So you're prepared and in the early stages of going back to the last point, in the early stages of that, those fledgling stages of the relationship, it's those little things that really matter. It's like that are those initial impressions. And one of the things that has always served me very well is because my follow-up and because I'm on time and people I've been largely reliable, is that it gives your customers this sense of confidence that makes them look good internally with whomever they are dealing with. Because, you know, in most cases, a customer, you know, is buying from you individually and they're an individual, and that decision to choose you and your company reflects upon them. Mm-hmm. And if you're making them look good and they know they have confidence in you, then that really kind of can solidify you inside the account. And so many of those little things is showing up on time and doing what you say you're going to do. And, you know, just critical.
Yeah. Well, like in the book where you point out that, and I hadn't thought about it, but it's probably true. As you said, yeah, it's unavoidable. Sometimes you're going to be late, but that's what cell phones were invented for. And it still drives me nuts. You know, when I'm talking to somebody selling something to me, and it happens quite frequently, and it's like, okay, you're late. You could have texted.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something I'm sort of, you know, I was going to say maybe too much is that, yeah, if I'm going to be late, even 5 minutes, 2 minutes, I'm going to send a text ahead of time or call somebody and say, you know, hey, forgive me, something's happened, but going to be there. And you're showing that you care enough and you respect their time enough.
Yeah.
To do that.
Yeah. Yeah. You've diffused a problem because I'm totally that way. And that is, you know, if I'm an appointment with someone at a certain time and they're 10 or 15 minutes late, I'm weird in the sense that I'm kind of stalled. I'm waiting for that. So I can't really be productive. If someone says, hey, I'm going to be 10 minutes late, oh, I know I can pick up the phone, call someone quickly, or I can do an email, or I can do something.
Well, so here's a question for you is and because this happens all the time to sellers, is the customer's late. So what you're seeing is the customer doesn't seem to respect my time as much as I'm trying to respect theirs. So in those instances, what do you, Brendan McAdams, say to a customer, or do you?
I have this is delicate, but I have a kind of a rule of thumb that if they're within a few minutes, 10 minutes or something like that, you know, I tolerate it. You know, if it happens every time, I may actually say something. If it's more than like 15 or so minutes, I will send them a message and say, let's reschedule. And then I'll basically kill it. You know, now it depends on whether I'm traveling. It depends, you know, if it's a phone call, those sorts of things. If someone tells me 5 minutes in, hey, I'm running late, I'm sorry, you know, I will oftentimes give them the out. Hey, you want to just reschedule? And I'll serve up a couple options. One of my standard sentences is give me a couple time slots and I'll make one of them work. And that saves me the trouble of going back and forth with calendars. If they just say, hey, here are two windows of time, I will find a way to make one of them work. And I use that as a way to kind of short circuit that. But if I can give someone an out, hey, they're backed up, let's reschedule, then I'll just tell them reschedule. If someone consistently is inconsiderate of my time, that tells me something about the state of the relationship and the deal. And I have walked away from deals where I just thought, even if we won, it wouldn't be good for the company, our resources, my time,
Great point.
You know, I think there are deals that you're better off losing to somebody else.
Or walking away from. And this is a part that, and you bring up a great point, and I think that too many salespeople don't think about it in this context, which is, you know, much as customers are choosing you, to some degree, you choose your customers. I mean,
absolutely.
If you're way underwater on quota, you're going to be less discriminating. But you know, if you're performing to plan or you're close to plan, you're building a book of business.
There are
customers, there are people at customers who are just not worth dealing with, and they're not worth your time. And it's okay to choose not to do business with them, even though it looks like they could buy from you. To your point, they could be, you know, hugely time consuming as a customer, hugely demanding, unreasonably demanding. There's a Herbert Simon, you know, we've talked about the show, a Nobel Prize winner economist, said people sort of fall into two categories: maximizers, satisficers, where maximizers are buyers that will look at every single option in order to convince themselves they made the right decision. You may find in your business, if you run across somebody who's a maximizer, you don't want to work that deal because you may never close that deal because they're always going to think there's something better around the corner, even though they sincerely, in one part of their mind, they sincerely intend to buy something.
Yeah.
They just can't bring themselves to do it because there must be something better out there I didn't see. And there's been studies done, I think Simon did it, saying that, maximizers do make perhaps more optimal decisions, but they're also more likely to be unhappy customers and have buyer's remorse because must have been something out there.
Yeah. Well, I've always thought being in sales and is just a tremendous career option. It's just, I've loved being in sales. And part of being in sales means you have to make it enjoyable for you. And if you're not selecting customers to some degree, if you're not being somewhat having a code, a standard, you know,
a personal code you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Your own code. Like this, if you're going to choose to have customers and you're going to put up with customers that are disrespectful to you, that belittle you, that waste your time, then you're kind of creating a sales environment that's reducing what's great about being in sales. And I one of the things about sales is I can to some degree choose my customers, especially as a consultant, as an independent. I've had customers that I have a 3-month engagement. At the end of 3-month engagement, hey, this has been great, thank you very much, and I go a different direction, and because they're just not. They don't want to take the advice. They don't want to execute. They pay the bills, but they don't. They're not referenceable. They're not happy. Right. They're, you know, those sorts of things. Yeah, I think you have a lot more control over your destiny than sometimes people give credit.
Well, you have to trust in yourself. That's a confidence thing, right? Is you have to have confidence that if you choose not to do business with a prospect, is that you've got enough in your pipeline or confident enough that you can build your pipeline to the point where it's not going to hurt you.
Yeah.
Which it sort of leads to another point you talked about, which I think is something that is worth discussing and not talked enough about is this, you know, being honest, being direct, being blunt with customers. You don't have to sugarcoat everything. In fact, you create the impression of sort of being unnecessarily subservient. Oftentimes, like sellers put themselves in a sort of position like a puppy. They don't want to be petted and have people say nice things to them. When really what the situation calls for, what the customer really wants is they want the seller to lead and inspire and be honest and direct about whatever issue comes up.
Yeah, right. And when I use like the Expertscape example is a good one for me, and that is we do a certain thing. We identify these experts objectively. And then I, in a presentation with people early on, I immediately explain these are some of the limitations. This is where you wouldn't use us. And by doing so, it diffuses that whole series of objections that people are naturally, you know, creating in their own mind about, it doesn't do this or, it's limited because of that. And if I sit there and can say right up front, this is what it doesn't do. You don't need us for these things. This is where we're good. This is where we're not good. And it immediately does a couple of things. It diffuses the objections that might come up. And it also it gives you much more credibility right up front. There are circumstances that where I will not sell to you is basically what you're saying.
And that's okay. I think that we don't say that enough. And I learned to do that from a mentor early in my career, to say, it's okay to tell people who you're not good for.
And
buyers, and just be upfront about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're setting sort of like a negative image or image you see on a negative of a photograph, but you're saying, okay, yeah, just want to see, this is who we're not good for. This is not a fit for us.
Yeah. Yeah. I say, explain that to a doctor the other day. I said, you don't need us. Here's what you do. I mean, you got what you need. If I can help you at some point down the road, by all means, and if I can do you a favor, whatever, that's fine. But you don't need to buy anything from us. I mean, you're doing great. And half the fun of that is they are so unaccustomed to seeing that reaction. And it's almost worth it.
Pharma reps and so on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, another thing that I want to touch on was, and this is something that I've read in several things recently, and I'm a huge believer in this and I've written about it, is that it's about being purposeful, right? It's not just following a script, following a playbook. You talk about from the context of meaningful touches. And I talk about from the context that, you know, every touch you have with a buyer should move them closer to making a decision. And if you don't accomplish that, then it wasn't a meaningful touch. There's no value in it for the buyer.
That's right.
And my friend Dave Brock writes about designing high value touches, which is very similar. So talk about what you described there. You talk about, you know, certain contexts. You talk about brevity, levity, value, and being on target. And I thought that was a great sort of little simple framework to think about designing a sales touch.
Yeah. So I wrote the book with the idea that people don't have a lot of, people are, attention. There's just this attention deficit issue that's going on. There's just so much information out there and people don't have attention spans. And that's certainly true when you are delivering any information to your customers. So in terms of brevity, nobody wants to have their time wasted. And at the same time, people like to look smart. They like to feel like they want to be able to look smart or get smarter in the least amount of time possible, the least amount of time and effort. And so to the degree to which you can help your customers understand things better, quickly, simply, is really important. So, marketing departments oftentimes generate all this great material, very sexy, highly, very visually appealing material or white papers, what have you. And they're great and they're good background material, but I find that where I've been very helped, where it's been very much appreciated, is when I can send to a customer, here's a white paper, here are the three takeaways that I think are that would be of interest to you, that are important given the project, and then explain how it would apply. And so I, I'm early an adopter to you. In one of your podcasts, you talk about some technology, and it gave you that it indicated how old you were, right? So I've been around since the start of email. So I typed email on a computer on a character based machine in Unix, and so I'm there from the early days of Unix and email, and so I can appreciate how important it is to do something in a way that's timely and very condensed, because people don't have time to read stuff. And so I put a trim. I just think people need to constantly be aware that they're getting bombarded with stuff. So the degree to which you can deliver things in a really simple, easily digestible manner is invaluable, I think.
Right. These days. And that's a perfect example is, and I think that needs to be used more frequently, is, yeah, you may have a white paper you want to send to a buyer, a customer, is summarize it. Here are the three key points, as you pointed out, is if they want to go back and read the whole thing later, they will. But to the point is, everybody's crushed for time. Summarize it. That's a very simple technique that, I see people do very rarely, is let me just summarize this for you. in a paragraph, three bullet points preferred, something they can scan. And you still get credit for giving them something of value that they'll say, yeah, okay, may I want to dig into this later, or, oh, these are great points, and that's fine.
Well, in this day and age, too, is they see that it's succinct, it's well-written. They'll cut and paste that and put it as something to somebody else.
Yeah.
And you know, which they can't do with a white paper, because now they're making a colleague read some you know, multi-page document that they didn't read, you know? Yeah. And so this way they can say, hey, here's this. And, you know, and it's just another way for them to look smart internally and to be informed internally and be responsive.
Right. And then you talk about levity, which I think is important, is we have a tendency to want to take ourselves too seriously. And we talked at the beginning of the show about being human, being a good human, being yourself. Yep. You talk in the book later about being your authentic self. It has nothing wrong with injecting some levity into the situation and showing that you're not taking yourself that seriously.
Right. And well, for me, one of the things, I find it, it's incredibly, what's the word? Calming isn't the right word, but to be able to not feel obligated to be the smartest person in the room. Mm-hmm. And like, I know what I know, but I think that when I go into sales situations, I'm eager to find out things that I don't know. And right. So I think it takes a lot of pressure off if I know I don't have to be the smartest guy. I don't have to feel like I have to be the smartest person in the room. And thankfully for me, that often is the case.
I can identify with that. Yes.
But that telegraphs nicely to everyone else in the room. And like, oh, this person is, they're being, well, they're not full of themselves.
Yeah.
Not,
self-deprecation is a great tool. I mean, obviously it can be laid on too thick and then it comes across as inauthentic, but again, this gets back to the point you were talking about again a little bit later in the book, or about being your authentic self, is you need to develop a sales personality if you're in sales. And
that's right.
It has to be congruent with who you are as a human being. It doesn't mean it's exactly the same as who you are. I mean, in my case, I'm very much of an introvert, but in sales situations or in situations like this, I'm more outgoing, but that's part of my sales personality. And having a little levity, not taking myself too seriously, willing to make jokes at my own expense.
Yeah.
It makes you just seem more human and more relatable, which is really, that's where that connection with another person comes from. As I say, well, yeah, I can relate to this person.
Yeah. I think that does. It's disarming.
Yeah. And it's in a good way.
Yeah.
So we're running a little bit out of time. I know that you've got a time. Just if you could sort of summarize the book for people. So if people say, I want to pick up this book, read it. Who did you really target with it? Is it beginners? Is it everybody? Is it, more? And because I have my own opinion on who would benefit from it.
So that's fascinating because I wrote it for the salesperson that wants to stay, that reads on a regular basis, that sees that as part of their kind of ongoing self-improvement program. And this is a way to kind of reinforce and introduce some new ideas and reinforce existing practices. So for new salespeople, I think it's a very good book in the sense that it condenses a bunch of fundamental ideas that are, I think, very digestible. They're very easy to understand, and it helps to have kind of a context, a story behind it. And a lot of them do have a story behind it that kind of explains, how it came to this, mm-hmm. this conclusion or how it applies. And so it's really useful for new to sales, sales professionals. The one other thing that someone told me is, and I, in fact, I've heard this more than a couple times now, is that it's really good for, I should write a version for founders, for startup founders, because founders often are, you know, introverted, you know, type individuals. You know, technical. They oftentimes come up with an idea and build on it, but yet they are responsible early on for selling. And so I'm probably going to write a version that's specifically targeted for founders, like just fundamental, practices, but with more of a founder kind of a perspective woven in.
Yeah. Well, I think a recipe for how to be a good human for many of those founders would be great. and so before you go, though, I did want to touch base on one thing. This was, I would say, is the most important, but it is a pretty critical part in the book. As you said, there are five things not to order at lunch when you're with a buyer. So five things not to eat at lunch when you're with a customer. Spaghetti, a second martini, breakfast, a prune smoothie, and chocolate cake. So I understand the issue with the second martini. So why a prune smoothie? Why shouldn't you order a prune smoothie at lunch?
I hope you can appreciate that some of these things were kind of very tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, yeah. So I appreciate that. I was just trying to understand what drove you to that.
Well, I'm fascinated by the whole idea of a, like, and this probably dates me as much as anything, and that is people don't call them prunes anymore. They've rebranded them as dried plums. And so it's a little bit like the Patagonian toothfish is now, what is it? It's,
hey, got me on that one.
It's another fish. It's Chilean sea bass.
No, it's Chilean sea bass.
So they didn't like the name. So I don't know. You know what it is? I wanted to introduce some levity, and I thought that's the least likely thing. And it telegraphs, it seems to me, a very kind of a...
Yeah, well, I think if you're, traditionally people resort to prunes if they're constipated, they need a laxative. So, yeah, you probably don't want to telegraph that necessarily in a meeting with or lunch with your buyer. A chocolate cake, though, I don't know. That seemed pretty harmless.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how that ended up in there.
Well, anyway... I recommend people take a look at the book, and as Brenda said, it's really a reference, more than a start to finish read through. You certainly can do it. It's easy enough to read, but just find one thing, breeze through it, find one thing that helps you sort of remind yourself, my attention has lapsed on this particular issue. I'm being a little careless and I need to pay more attention to what I'm doing. And it could just be something as simple as I said, being on time. You sort of let that slide.
Yeah.
Everything makes a difference because sales, if people really want to think about it, sales is, it's not a continuum. When you're selling to a customer, we talk about a process and so on, but it's really a series of moments, discrete moments. And at each of those moments, you're creating an impression on this person. And the things you really deal with in the book are really a preponderance of that. Yeah, how do I create that right impression in the eyes of the buyer to make them want to choose me to do business with? And so I think we all can sort of pay close attention to that.
Andy, that's exactly right. And thank you. That's a great way to kind of summarize salescraft and the kind of reason I wrote it and who it's for I couldn't do a better job of summarizing it than that.
Send you an address where you can send the check. I'll be your publicist. So, all right. Well, Brendan, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. At last, I said we've been having this in the works for a long time. Tell people how they can learn more about the book and learn more about ExpertScape.
Well, the book is the best way to get the book is on Amazon Salescraft, and it's Brendan McAdams is the author. That's how you basically find it. It's on Kindle and also on a hard copy. And then hopefully you never have to use ExpertScape. But if you do, it's expertscape.com, ExpertScape, because my partner and I both worked at what became WebMD. It was called Healthion.
Mm-hmm.
But the name before Healthion was Healthscape because the founder was Jim Clark.
Right.
Was one of the founders who started Netscape with Mark Andreessen. And so we're ExpertScape as a result of from that, because that's how we got our start. So.
All right. And that's ExpertScape.com?
Yep. That's
excellent.
Right.
All right. Well, Brendan, great to talk to you and look forward to doing it again.
Andy, it was a pleasure. And thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, friends, that was Accelerate for the week. First of all, as always, I want to thank you for joining me, and I want to thank my guest, Brendan McAdam. Join me again next week as my guest will be Mary Grothy. Mary is the founder and CEO of SalesBQ and host of the Quota Crusher podcast. You want to join us as we have a fun conversation about the power of passion, conviction, and enthusiasm in sales. You'll definitely want to check this out. Be sure to join Mary and me next week for that conversation. So again, thanks for joining me on Accelerate this week. Until next week, I'm your host, Andy Ball. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.